Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Christian Corley, and with me are James McLean and Gareth Cavanagh, and we are here to discuss Doctor Who Series 11, Episode 8. That's where we are already. The Witchfinders by Joy Wilkinson. With a tasty guest cast and plunging the Doctor and friends into the days of finding witches. As you can guess by the title. This is a story which seems to... in terms of fan reaction, which we'll come to later in more detail, seems to have gone down quite well. Nice to have you back, Gareth.
Yay. Hello. It's always good to be back. You know, I feel I turn up when Doctor Who takes it up to.
It's all down to you.
It is. See, I've chosen my weeks well. Yeah, great to be back.
So how many have you watched now?
Oh, that's an evil question. Let's see. I still haven't watched... I've watched the last three in a row, and they're good. I still haven't watched the Pregnant Man one. I still haven't watched the Outer Space Wacky Racers one. And I still haven't seen the remake of Arachnophobia. So, right.
The Pregnant Man one, the Pregnant Man is the least worst thing about the Pregnant Man one, I think.
Okay.
Probably.
I'll get to them eventually. But I am enjoying this whole sort of Star Trek-y vibe. Original series that you can just watch them all in any order and it doesn't matter, and that's pretty good.
Yeah,
well, it's funny because a lot of people have been saying, well, why are they showing them in this order? Why not save some of these quote unquote better episodes? Why not, instead of saving them for the end of the series, why not use them earlier on?
Oh, come on. If you'd opened up the series with Rosa Parks, you know, the Punjab, and then, you know, and admittedly richly fruity, you know, James the First, you know, it would have been like one of those bloody schools and colleges programs. you know, to be fair, you know, and I'm not entirely sure that would have, everyone would have said, oh no, this is all a bit you know, a bit boring. So, yeah, I understand why. But, yeah, but I do like the idea that you can dip in and out, well, as I'm proving, and lose absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
It's quite refreshing.
All right, so where should we start with? Shall we start with Mr. Alan Cumming?
Oh.
A man who was suggested by many fans back in the day as a future Doctor. No doubt will probably not play the Doctor now. However, I do feel that this episode may be overshadowed by him somewhat, and everyone's going to forget what it's called and just call it the one with King James in it.
Oh, and rightly so. because I work on Sundays, I don't get to see anything go out live. So, you know, but obviously my phone pings away furiously with people updating things. And when I opened the phone and saw an update from a good pal of mine who said, my God, Alan Cumming's has gone the full Graham Crowden on this. And I thought, I literally thought, oh my God, get me home at once. That's how I got home. I was like, I must watch this, you know, and my God, it didn't disappoint. It was absolutely 11 on the fruitometer. It was such a great, pleasureful performance. You know, better than Bruce Purchase. You know, better than Graham Crowden. This is the new high watermark of fruitiness. Absolute top draw. I can't say enough good things about it. So I better pass over to you guys before I swoon with pleasure.
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, like I say, I think it's going to be... I think you've missed one of the great fruity performances out there, which, of course, has got to be Michael Robbins.
Oh, madam, you jest. Yeah, it's in exactly that same ballpark, but it makes Michael Robbins look restrained and, you know, and, yeah, like he's really pulling his punches. This is just, this is a full on exquisite. Oh, more profuse. Yes, but you're right. It's in that same bit of the Venn diagram.
I have full appreciation of what you're saying there. James, how do you feel about this sort of approach to the characterization of King James?
I don't know.
Do you find it distracting?
I found it tonally confusing.
Mm.
I like the performance. I think Cummings was having a great time, and I thought he was a lot of fun. It just felt as if they'd given him his own personal director and everyone else was, I don't know, it just felt very jarring. And maybe that was intentionally so, to give it a bit of lightness. I personally would have perhaps preferred it without him, in a sense. And then at the same time, it had perhaps needed something else to lift it. So I don't know. It was for me, it was a very confusing story.
Burn the heretic. This is one of the best things I've ever seen. No, I get it. We're back to the console room and the big spring sound in Horns of Nymon. You either love it or you don't. I don't think there's a sort of mild appreciation of this. I think you either absolutely love it or you don't. I think it's impossible to sit on the fence with this one.
I mean, it's not just him. There's just lots of things going on there which are good and I won't say not good. There's bits of it which felt quite generic. There was bits of it which were really interesting. There were bits of it which were sort of like, I say, like Cummings, which was beautiful performances, but I wasn't sure whether I wanted him to be there, which I think is perhaps the best way of putting it. Because, I mean, Horns of Nymon, to be fair, there isn't really a saving grace to it tonally so far as is it. It feels pretty much the same thing all the way through. There's nothing which jars.
It is what it is from minute one.
Maybe Visitation is the nearest comparison for that sort of blend of quite serious tonal storyline and then campy guest character.
I mean, we don't really know what King James was like, really, do we?
Was he like Alan Cummings on crack?
I'll bet he was. You know, I'm willing to say I bet he was.
I hope he was.
Well, you know,
it's just a very, I don't know. I think, I mean, like I said, I don't think it was a bad story. I think the production.
You can't accuse him of dialing it in. Let's be frank. For me, it's the kind of performance I don't see at all on television anymore. Even Game of Thrones, which should have room for a nice Alan Cummings, super fruity, you know, guest appearance, we don't even get it in that. You know, for God's sake, this is what RADA should be for. It should be, you know, not just churning out, leading chavs and, all the sort of things that we've become quite good at and our television appears to be infested with, but really magnificent, top fruit-a-thon, you know, extravagant, pleasurable performances like this. And I think it clearly was a time of contradiction. It was a time of great hypocrisy. And I think, you know, and I think they get to that quite well. I mean, I think without him, you just have the horror of this woman's just murdered 36 people in a row. And it's not British justice's finest hour, is it? You know, if you drown, you're innocent. And if you don't drown, well, we'll hang you because you're a witch. You know, it's... It needs him and that lightness. And
but it's an odd thing because he's not. The performance is light, but the character is not. I mean, in a sense, he brings no more. He does not lighten the situation. In fact, in some ways, you could argue he almost makes it more claustrophobic, because you do suddenly have this central power which comes in, who for all his colour. Is still very much a controlling force within those dynamics.
Yeah, I can see the argument that if he doesn't turn up, the Doctor gets to flash her magic psychic paper and maybe gets to then control the situation. But does she really? You know, the minute all the mud monsters turn up, her saying no more burning of witches kind of goes out the window, doesn't it?
Well, that was my other problem with this story for me personally, and I'm not saying it was wrong, just for my pleasure factor, was I was getting about a quarter of the way through and I was thinking, because I don't watch the pre-trailers, sorry, the trailers. Are we actually going to have a historical one here? And I was thinking, cool, this could be quite interesting if it's darkly historical, especially if it's playing this thing where we're almost expecting to find magic in terms of alienness in a story about witchcraft. And then, of course, the mud starts moving, and there's a sort of mild disappointment that we had to go back to the, you know, the monster creatures, which, again, I think to me that was the biggest issue of the story, was as the monster creatures felt very sandwiched in.
Yeah, there's no kind of Chekhov's gun about them, was there? It was like you've got sentient mud, and the next thing you've got like aliens imprisoned under a hill.
Yeah, and I suppose the first time in a long time you have an alien which could actually be an adversary, of a sentient adversary, who is expunged within, you know, eight minutes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that I think to me that was more the issue. I think if it had been, and to me this could have been, if you take that bit out, this could have been a big Finnish adventure, especially because Cummings is so very, it's his intonation and how he plays the character as much as how he physically performs it, which makes it what he is.
No, he'll be back, don't worry. King James Investigates box set. And they can take my £50 right now. But yeah, I know what you mean. It was I thought it was a shame. If you had to go back and have an alien menace or a monster, I'd have been quite happy for them to cut into the hill and have Azal the demon pop out or something like that. That would have been really quite good fun. And probably a bit more subtle, as you say, than some alien mud thing that's been sort of crudely popped into the bottle. Bizarrely with a tree, which, let's face it, you know, could have quite easily been knocked down any time in the past 400 years.
Mm. Yeah.
But I digress. You know, I mean, yeah, the mud. But they looked good, though. The zombies looked good. You know, I mean, I watch, you know, one of my Monday treats is The Walking Dead. And I thought those, you know, especially old grandma mud looked about as scary as anything I've seen in The Walking Dead. And I think there'll be a lot of, you know, kiddos who going, oh, well, you know, Doctor Who ain't that scary no more, going, ooh, ooh, ooh. You know, perhaps that is. I think it kind of had the lot.
Yeah. What about the TARDIS team? Did we see them having enough to do for all four characters?
I thought they were fine. I think they all got a moment, which, I mean, again, it depends on how much emphasis one feels you need in the TARDIS team. And, you know, we're flitting, in a sense, we're sort of going backwards in time. You know, we've spent a lot of time sitting at the sort of back end of the 80s with the Ace or Benny Summerfield character, you know, relevant to the story, where they're very much in the forefront. And now we've sort of slipped back to sort of almost like 25 years before that, and you've got this sort of amalgamate crew, which all have something to do, but nothing amazing to do either. And I'm quite all right with that. I thought, because they all had something. They all had either interactions with the king, or they were dealing with the peasants, or they were dealing with the witches. They all had some sort of position there. It felt very old school. I can see why Gareth is so
you damn me with faint praise, sir.
why he's so Alan coming all over this. It's just
it's still my beating heart. Actually, yeah. I'm gonna throw the odd brickbat at this now. There was a brilliant event with Eric Sayward and Matthew Waterhouse at the BFI a couple of weeks ago I was at. And someone asked Eric, you know, this thing where they get rid of Adric, and they said, well, you know, this was your way of whittling down the companions. And he said, well, yes, it was a go. He said the format of the Doctor and one companion worked for a very good reason. he said, because you don't have to then invent plot strands to keep the companions busy. And he said that was permanently the problem in my era, because I had three companions a lot of the time. He said, so I would always be having to come up with a separate plot strand for each of the companions to do. So, you know, Nyssa in the TARDIS in Earthshock, or Tegan wandering around with the troopers, or, you know, he said it actually got in the way of the plot a lot of the time and slowed the action right down, because actually I wanted to hit the ground running very fast, have things centered around the Doctor, have the companion there. Obviously, he's part of the mix and for peril, but when I have to do that for three or four, it's a problem. And I think Uncle Eric has completely put his finger on the problem with this era, is there was at least one companion too many with not enough to do. And this week it felt like it was Yaz who didn't have much to do, who was really just there to go off and chat to the granddaughter and not really have much impact on the plot one way or another. And in fact, you could have lost both of those characters and absolutely nothing would have changed. In fact, you, apart from the sort of comedy flirting, you could have dispensed with them all and maybe just had Graham, who I thought was pretty good and had something to do. So I think the Sayward maxim does hold true. And I think whatever happens, I think we need to lose at least one companion, possibly two.
You see, I totally disagree with that. And I've never understood this rationale, which seems to situate itself around singly this show, as if no other show has ensemble casts of any type whatsoever or has any more than two people. It seems as if it's got transfixed with its own formula. And for me, frankly, I really enjoy the early Davison ones. I really enjoy the early Hartnell ones.
But the Hartnell ones are different because that is, you know, the leads are Ian and Barbara.
Well, this is the question to me, and this is why I agree with Eric, is it's not so much how many you've got. It's to some degree who you've got. And well, whether Eric, they are Eric's charming
never,
enough.
But Eric is never able to solve it, is he? You know, Kinder, Nyssa goes to sleep for the whole thing. So he gets rid of her that way.
But then Nyssa wasn't meant to be there at that point, was it? She was a late inclusion. There was something like that. She had to be written out because there was... I'm sure that was the case.
I'm pretty sure Adric has very little to do in a lot of them. You know, I mean, Black Orchid, I think he just eats and says, what's a screwdriver?
But is that a problem? I mean... You know, Star Trek, how many... I mean, everyone sort of knows about Scotty and they enjoy Sulu for whatever reason. And yet both of them... I mean, Scotty, to be honest, had a reasonable amount of screen time, but
Scotty is the chief engineer. You know, you kind of have to have one.
But you don't
have to have three characters travelling with the Doctor. You can have two.
I think maybe the secret to this was uncovered by Barry Letts and Russell T Davies. And that is to have a place where the Doctor can be based and then have the surrounding characters, Brigadier, Benton.
That's Mickey, true, yeah.
Jackie.
So with Russell, you've got Captain Jack and Mickey come and go.
Exactly, yeah. And then when you just want the two, just want the Doctor and primary companion, then they can poodle off through a time eddy or go off in the TARDIS, depending on the era, yeah. You know.
But even this feels like very limited thinking in the sense that, I mean, I remember there was when they started the Seventh Doctor comic strips in Doctor Who Monthly, they had a period without Ace because it was still moving on without the TV companion. And it was just a suggestion that he dropped her off in the Cretaceous period because she wanted to hit things. And then later on, he went and picked her up again. And especially at this time where they, let's pronoun it, have control over the TARDIS, you can just say that person is off exploring X and you have two companions if the story only needs two companions. It just feels a very odd thing that we have this fixation with this show that there's got to be, you know, a Doctor and a companion. And I just don't buy that.
But a lot of it is that the showmakers themselves put great store in the new companion. You know, and you know, you're comparing this, good comparison with the Visitation. You know, Michael Robbins completely dominates the rest of the cast.
Yeah.
In that piece, because he's far more interesting. And you get a sense that Eric's far more enjoying writing for him than he is writing for Tegan, Nyssa, and Adric. You know, let's be honest, Nyssa spends all the time in the TARDIS building a stereo. I don't really know what Tegan does in the visitation, if I'm being honest. I can't remember much. She seems to be hypnotized for most of it, building boxes of things. And I can't even tell you what Adric does. So I think there's a problem there when the actual characters come in who are more interesting. And I think in this one, Alan Cummings is more interesting than two of the three companions.
But is that a problem? Because surely to some degree, a guest star should be more interesting. They should have a certain flair and a certain relevance to what you're watching that should guide you to them over the regulars. Apart from...
But we only have about 48 minutes of screen time to play with.
But so did Star Trek. So did most American shows which had ensemble casts. And you can go to the cop genre for even more examples.
But Star Trek's a quasi-military thing based on the Navy. So, you know, Sulu, you expect him to be sat behind the desk.
But there's not... I mean, what I'm saying, there's not many shows of any length where you would say, really, we only need two cast members and then the rest is irrelevant. I can see the argument when you're dealing with a semi-anthology that there could be an argument that you reduce your number of central characters to a degree to make things flow. But given that I still think this, the history of Doctor Who has shown to me anyway, that more times out of not, when there's more than one companion, the show has been more interesting.
No, but I honestly think the memory cheats there, because I think you're at a point. But the thing about the Doctor Who formula, as we know it, is when you've got more than one companion, the companion's there because you need the Doctor to have someone to talk to, because the Doctor is so much more brilliant. So you've got to have someone who comes in with a different kind of perception. And yeah, we've seen that a lot. But it doesn't work, I think, when you've got the Doctor surrounded by three people and they're all in the same scenes together. So at some point, you have to split them off. And if you split them off, you then have to have a B and a C plot for them to investigate and to look into. And I think in this case, I thought the granddaughter as a B or a C plot, I didn't need, and I didn't think I did much. And I think that, yeah, the flirting was hilarious, but it didn't necessarily have, it could have been anyone. I think the only one who had a moderately strong reason to do anything other than what is it, Doctor, or I'll go and look at that tree, Doctor, or I'll go and speak to the girl, Doctor, was Graham.
But then I like Ryan. I think he's an okay character. I liked his interactions with Cummings. I liked Graham's little pieces because I just think he's a good character. I'm not sold on Yaz.
She had very little to do this week, actually. Yeah, I think you're right.
I still think Yaz still exists as a sort of model of the new Who companion and doesn't really fit in this because she's got no... There's nothing normal about her. You can feel, as I've said before, she feels like she's burst. She's like a character in the back of a stage play waiting to burst into song, because she's the same sort of archetype as Rose, as Martha, as Clara. This amazing, wonderful person restrained by the normalcy of the world, bored in her job and wants to prove herself to be something bigger, and you know the Doctor normally produces that, and yet she's bound and locked in this.
I don't think that's Yaz at all. I think Yaz is very comfortable with who she is and what, and is applying all of her police training and knowledge.
But she's not in the situation pilot. She plays all the trappings. She's in a job where she's not recognised for her worth. It's frustrating. She's young. She wants to do more than she can. And that normally sort of catapults her into a world of the new Who, Doctor Who. I mean, I would say yes, it depends on... There's a two-way problem here. You have the fact that unless you have... Because they have less screen time, they've got to be very charming actors, I think, to carry the less dialogue and make themselves interesting. So there's always a risk there. But if you just have the one, you have the risk that the person isn't that interesting or is overblown, and they become incredibly frustrating for the audience because they've got no one else to sort of, they've only got two characters to work with or to enjoy. And personally, I don't like Yaz, not because of the actress. I think she's really good, but I just don't feel that character is real to me. It feels
ego, she's disposable. You could so just have two. You could just have Ryan and Graham.
You could have two.
And we'd be okay.
I would argue that I'd argue that two is the perfect number for me. One is two. It's Goldilocks again. It's like an article I've written recently. One is
Turlo and Tegan. I always thought was quite good. They were quite good as a pair.
But I didn't mind it with Turlo, Tegan, and Issa, because ultimately, to me, Doctor Who characters don't have that much to bring, because they are part of anthologies, so their backgrounds are largely outside of a story. So to me, they're always going to be slightly superficial. So it depends on who you just quite like. And I like Turlo, I like Harry, I like Jamie, I like Zoe, I like Ian, I like Barbara.
But it's interesting, but they all end up with a plot function. And if you're looking at Nyssa and if you're looking at Turlo, they're really there where you need the Doctor in two places at once. So if you need someone who can move the TARDIS, or can wave something around, or can do some scientific analysis, so you need the Doctor in two places at once. That's pretty much all that Turlo and Nyssa are really there for.
But you could argue that's
their distinctive quality, because Tegan can't do that. And Adric ends up being used for the same purpose, where you need the Doctor in three places. So I think in Earthshot, you've got Nyssa in the TARDIS, is doing a Doctor job. You've got Adric on the bridge trying to crack the code, is doing a Doctor job. And then you've got the Doctor in the TARDIS, or the Doctor off exploring, doing the Doctor job. So it's a bit of a cheat, because it lets you do three different things. At the moment, they haven't got that with the companions they have. So the companions can only explore, reflect, or deal with the sort of much weaker B and C plots that actually you don't need anyway.
It is a naive Ian 60s, not Ian and Barbara situation. I don't disagree. And yeah, I think I've always felt that having an extra Doctor involved is always good for the show, which is why I was so surprised they never utilised Jack.
That's true. Although I suppose they did have River Song then, who was
in and out. Absolutely.
Your spare Doctor.
And also the other thing as well is we do tend to get fixated on the number of people that are travelling in the TARDIS. And as I mentioned before, we have this situation with like the unit and the Davies here, where the Doctor can go home and do things with the family or whatever. When River Song pops into the TARDIS during the 11th Doctor era, those occasions, you've got three companions.
Yeah.
So you've got that sort of three companion thing going on, that four-person dynamic. And then again, you've got Jack, and some of the best episodes of certainly Davies' era are episodes with one companion and Captain Jack.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
So, which does lead me to suspect that that's possibly the dynamic that they should be exploring more, rather than... And, you know, forget Rory and Amy, because that never really worked because of the relationship. And the same with Clara and that fella, whose name escapes me because he was so good.
I forgot about Danny Pink.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Again, that didn't work because he was hardly in the TARDIS. And when he was, it was just all arguing and nothing, you know, it was not a high point in Doctor Who in my mind. So...
They didn't want to be travelling. You know, Danny Pink, you never got the impression that Danny or Rory actually wanted to be there. And I suppose what you do have with the current crop is they all want to be there.
Yeah.
Which is why when you see Arachnid, so I'll be interested to see what you think, because that is an episode which, if you take that out, it becomes far more satisfying, because you don't have this acknowledgement that they want to be there. And we have this, as I've said before, this very arrogant Western, let's go and explore the native world, or, you know, let's go and meet the natives and we'll be fine, because, you know, this is what we should be doing, jetpacking around the world. It's got that sort of familiarness of New Who again, which I just don't think it needed. But I think what we could perhaps agree on then is what you need is that ability, a stronger ability for the show to find a way to bring characters in and out. So you're not stuck with a singular Doctor companion thing, which I still don't believe has ever been successful, really. For me, anyway. For others, it has been. But for me, anyway, for the show. Bar maybe Sarah, Ace and Romana.
Largely
speaking, yeah, I like to have at least two characters there to play a dynamic within themselves. And again, yeah, but so maybe it needs to be looking at someone outside of outside of contemporary period, which I think if you've got three in the TARDIS, and I think that's what makes Rose, Jack and the Doctor quite fun, is they're not all, they're all from different periods or different worlds. So yeah. I think that can be a nice thing. And the same with Dr. Jamie and Zoe. You have that again, that same fun.
Or Victoria.
Very strong set. Yeah, you're right.
And let's face it, okay, they're not alien, but Harry, Sarah and the Doctor, you know, are fairly sort of differential archetypes in themselves. So again, you need to have a strong dynamic, but you perhaps need that ability to be able to find a way in the show to take people out when you don't need them without writers feeling they've got
it's true, I mean ditching Harry I think is the really the one mistake that Hinchcliffe makes in his whole run. I think
Definitely.
You know, I think all his other calls are right, but I think, and I remember asking Hinchcliffe about this and he did say yeah, that was difficult. He really wrestled with that one and he came down in the end with just liking the chemistry between Liz and the Doctor, and that was it. But he did acknowledge that was a tough call, and I think arguably he gets that one probably wrong, although I don't know really. But then what does Harry do in season 13 that Sarah and the Doctor can't cover?
But then you get that question of, well, most shows you could truncate most characters into, you know, a couple, and because most ultimately you probably only have 2 to 3 driving people within a protagonist in a story, unless you start splitting them out. I think a lot of it's for colour and it's a lot of it's for fun. I mean, if you think, I know we don't have to do this, but we think back to Ark in Space, or you think of Revenge of the Cybermen, either sort of some of the most fun moments, so not just the moments between Tom and Sarah, but they'll be from between the Doctor and Harry, or Sarah and Harry.
Yes.
And they couldn't just be one-liners, but they stick with you for decades. So I think if you get that right balance, it is a lot of beautiful colour for stories.
I can see Harry Sullivan in something like Pyramids of Mars really adding, actually, and actually being quite nice in that. But then is it Harry Sullivan that does all the sort of shooting of gelignite and, you know, and blowing things up? Maybe Sarah gets a different kind of role in that story. I don't know. It's a really difficult what if, because you're tinkering with something that's almost sort of perfect. Mm. And would that extra ingredient unbalance it, or would it add to it?
I don't know, because I mean, you could just say, well, what's about if Ark in Space had just had Sarah and the Doctor, which it could have easily done, really. Yeah. Would it have been more perfect? Maybe it would have, but I'd rather like it. I like Harry. I look forward to seeing episodes with Harry. And the general model would have normally refused him if it hadn't been for this notion that, as we know, the Fourth Doctor would have been older and they're looking for like a Harry, an Ian. And Ian Chesterton to sort of offset that.
Oh, the Mr. Pastry. Yes. It needs someone to thump people. Yeah.
But yeah, no. So anyway, for this one, yeah, I this series, I'd have been happy. I know it's cruel to say, I'd have been happy to have had no Yaz.
I didn't think there was enough for her to do, and I think it showed. What do you think, Mr. Christian, our beloved leader? What did you think of this week?
Oh, well, you asking me that, it puts me in mind the fact that last week James and I didn't offer a rating for last week's episode, which is something we've been doing every episode, and then we forgot last week. This one, I've seen it twice, because I watched it last night, and then I watched it again this morning with Bruce, because Bruce got to watch this one, because it didn't have particularly difficult questions.
Scary mud monsters, though.
Scary mud. Well, obviously, there's the whole witch trials thing, which he didn't ask me about. So I think the Halloween thing probably takes that away. I think there's an expert bit of writing there. And I think it's just a very well-written episode, as good as we've had through the series. And it is telling that, sadly, in some ways, I suppose, that the stronger episodes all appear to have been written by not the showrunner. Yes. I enjoyed it. It was fun. It's which is something that has been missing. I did find it fun. I think it's largely due to Alan Cumming. I think a different actor could, you know, stick, I don't know, many other actors in there, it wouldn't have been nearly as fun. I can think of a few that it would have been fun with, but I think he definitely took it to a different place.
It's like Jack Nicholson in The Shining to me. I now cannot imagine anyone else playing that role.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, Derek Riddle did a good job of James I in the Kit Harington Guy Fawkes thing last year or the year before. But I mean, this takes it into a completely different place.
Oh, I can't imagine it was like that.
No, it totally wasn't. No, I mean, it was all there, but it was absolutely nothing like that. And generally a good cast episode and well shot. And, you know, like
it looked good. It did look good.
Yeah. It did look good. I do. It's the monsters that really kind of, if anything spoilt it for me, it's just the sudden appearance of, you know, war criminal mud monsters under the hill, and the quick bit of info dump on how they got there. It's that just.
How do you solve it though with no mud monsters? If the Doctor turns up and King James says, "Yeah, I believe this is the work of Satan." Anyone who says it isn't is also in.
Well, I think the way, and I we'll think burn the way you said them. It, have a Satan under the hill.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's the way, but once we got, if
Azal or one of his little mates Bazal turned from underneath the bloody mound, we'd have all creamed our silks. It would have been, oh my God, instant classic. You know, poor old Ian Devine would have come out of his self-imposed exile and gone, Doctor Who is back. It is incredible. You know, and I'm sure it wouldn't have cost much to get Azal off Barry Letts' estate.
And I'm sure it wouldn't have cost much to get Ian Levine in there as well, as playing an older generation version, you know, a sort of ancestor of Benton.
Oh, yes.
He could have been in there. And then we could have had a little Baal, and then we could have even just because the fans have loved it, just actually inserted the Brigadier moment with the five-shot rapid. Just put it in there. Just no effort.
Five axes rapid. Yes.
And then there'd have been lots.
Well, maybe
of
not. I wouldn't say go that far, but I just think that you know that leap from sentient mud, which put me in mind of there's an Eighth Doctor novel with some sort of like sentient mud. Yeah, one of the Caught in Earth ones, the Burning. I think it's the Burning. And obviously, and you've got the whole Gollum thing there as well. You know, the Hebrew myth. You could have gone in that direction as well with it.
Yeah.
But instead, you've got war criminal aliens who've been desiccated and planted in a hill. It just that leap, I think, needed more to it. Earlier on, maybe some local coat of arms or something with a strange creature on it that turns out to be the alien.
It is a weakness of the format.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, how long did it run? Like 50 minutes. So you've got 5 minutes of apple bobbing. You've then got 5 minutes of witch drowning. Then you've got don't burn the witches. Then you've got a little chat in the house. Then you've got 8 minutes of high fruit content when King James turns up. That's half your episode gone, you know. And then a little bit more wandering around and high fruitiness. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, okay, mud. You know, you've only got 15 minutes left to really explain the mud away.
Yeah.
And pop the cork in the tree. And then a last fruity dish to see us on our way and off. So it's a problem.
I just think, I mean, there's two ways I'd have done it. And the one way I was hoping they would do it is the same issue I always had with the X-Files, is it just felt like a moment where you could have played the notion that there was going to be something alien in it. And then at the end of it, switch it round, and perfect for witch hunters to find that there is actually a very rational explanation. And there's a sort of a rational send out, something to do with poison, something to do with the granddaughter, maybe something to do. I don't know. You could have. I felt there was an excuse here to play a very different sort of ending to this, which sort of surprised people and played to the air and give you a historical story. The other way to have done it, which is probably more the better middle ground, would have had it simply that I get to the point when she's starting to drip mud from her eye. So the explanation, I don't want to be complex. It could just be, you could have just had a mud contagion, something in the mud which is actually affecting people, which she's activated, and then it's just a matter of MacGuffining deactivating it. So just don't feel like the mud is the important thing in there. People don't care about the mud. They're compared to
all very Victor humans. Pemberton then, isn't it?
Yeah.
Victor Pemberton and his sentient mud.
Yeah, I just feel that they could have just something far more simple without this long backstory. I mean, I thought the way it was going to be, that in very New Who style, the Mud was simply having to try and get back to her, as they sort of suggested at one point, the Mud would consume her and then would just turn into mud again. And then they would somehow just collect it up and then take it away to another planet or something like that. That, to me, felt like where that story just needed to be, because ultimately the story you were watching was this question of the witch trials. So, yeah, I just felt that the ending, where suddenly we find there's an alien race that's been imprisoned under a tree and now has to be imprisoned again.
But on the positive side, you know, we didn't get Grandma brought back to life again. So, you know, it's a good thing in this era. Dead means dead.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't a happy ending for Lady McMud. She got fried by King Fruit and not brought back and not saved. You know, anyone else in either of the previous eras, I think he'd have talked the mud out of her and the mud would have just slid into the ground and she'd have woken up going, oh, what a terrible dream. So, you know, I think there's a lot of positives there. And yeah, it was a bit rushed and a bit forced. But I suppose it'd be like trying to do the demons as a two-parter in 1971, you know, it would feel rushed.
I think my problem with the era, largely for me with the companions, is, I know I'm sort of jumping track a little, but it's still bugging me a bit, is still that Arachnids episode. And unfortunately, because they've had that Arachnids episode, they've never really dealt with any other way of dealing with it. This idea now that they're sort of going along because it's fun, because they want to see the universe, it still doesn't. I think somehow that takes a bit away from them and does make the characters seem a bit.
This is interesting because I haven't seen that one. You see, I'm spared that from my narrative.
So that doesn't exist. Yeah. Do you find without that or any notion that they are just perpetually carrying on like, you know, stuck in the TARDIS?
No, I think they're being to an extent true to their characters. Yaz is being a copper, so she's trying to almost restore order and calm wherever she goes, like some galactic copper. And I think Graham and, oh God, who's the other lad called? This is ridiculous.
Ryan.
Yeah, sorry. He is a bit forgettable. Graham is almost carrying on his mission. You know, that he'd had that great opening as a person when he met his wife. And even though she's died, he's now carrying on with that spirit of adventure, and Ryan is the young lad along for the ride. I think they're all being consistent to who they are as characters, but obviously I've been spared this, what sounds like a slightly forced let's go backpacking around the universe and the Doctor is like their cool guide, and you know, let's go and take in Vietnam and Cambodia and all sorts of things, but they're doing it in a time travel-y way, so instead of going to sort of where all the beaches are, they might be turning up where thousands of people are being murdered. But yeah, I'm spared that. So I think they're consistent to who those characters are. But when you've only got 50 or 48 minutes of screen time, I really could have lost, or, you know, I'd rather have repurposed Yaz's 8 minutes of B and C plot into maybe making the mud reveal a little bit more fleshed out or satisfying. Or frankly, just had 8 minutes of Alan Cumming reading the 15th century phone book. But I accept that's just me.
Okay, let's hit Facebook, and then once we've done that, we'll check some of the comments. So I asked yesterday evening after The Witchfinders, how do you feel about The Witchfinders? First respondent was Owen Lucas. Best episode of this series so far. I was expecting / hoping for the Master to put in an appearance. Yeah. Jeff Waddell.
Oh, my dear Doctor, you have been naive.
Yes. 8 episodes in, and we finally get a great episode of Doctor Who, says Jeff Waddell. I've enjoyed the two previous historical episodes greatly, but they weren't great Who episodes. But I think he likes, as he says, this one is a great episode. Stuart Kershaw, things have picked up after the mid-series slump. Lewis David Blaney, a wonderfully wacky episode filled with ghastly monsters, a bleak setting, and as expected, a brilliant performance by Alan Cumming. Jodie Whittaker's performance has been wonderful, and she's certainly growing per episode. What do you think of Jodie? Because obviously you've not watched things in the right order, so...
Well, I think she's probably the weakest thing about it, I'm sad to say, at the moment. I think she's still finding her feet. I think the character is beginning to find a bit of that authority this week that I felt has been lacking in previous weeks. And maybe the clue is in that phrase this week where she said we've got a very flat team structure. So it is a very different kind of Doctor, and I am sort of readjusting to that. She does only seem to have about 3 facial expressions so far. So I am still sort of waiting for a bit more. And I suppose it's all sort of, because it's all sort of low rent, middle of the road sort of problems and issues we haven't had, which is nice, you know, because it was tiring when every week it was the end of the universe.
Yeah.
I suppose I'm waiting for that big, I don't know, Sutek style episode or a big Dalek episode or something where there's something where it's a little bit more at stake and it's a little bit more less cozy. But I think she's growing in stature. I think she's definitely growing in stature, and it's probably more like that first Peter Davison season in that respect, where, you know, we're starting to see a different Doctor emerge. So yeah, I mean, okay. certainly still evolving. I don't think we'll know what we've got till probably the end of the season.
Yeah. Okay. There's an interesting comment here. This is Gareth Lloyd. Another samey episode full of huge leaps in exposition. Can we have the likes of Paul Connell, Rob Sherman, or some of the big Finnish writers on the series who understand the show a bit more? Now, that's an interesting point, but I would say, yeah, Paul Connell, 3 episodes, he's written 2 stories. Rob Sherman, 1. And none of them are, I mean, Father's Day aside, which is very much a TV episode, but the other ones didn't originate as TV episodes. They originated as a novel and an audio, and neither of them have written for the show in a decade.
No, that's true. I'm not sure I'd agree with that at all. I think out of the ones I've seen, and it's quite possible I haven't seen the weaker episodes by the sound of it, I would disagree with that completely.
I think the better episodes are by people new to Doctor Who.
Yeah, they've been fresh and interesting and exciting. And yeah, I don't think we'll really get to understand what kind of influence or how that writer's room has worked. But everything has felt a little bit more... a little bit more together, you know, because in the past everything's felt very disjointed, but it's been sort of, they've had sort of arcs crudely welded to the back of them,
yes,
to make them feel like they're the whole thing, but really they're not. But this feels, you know, it feels a lot more like a whole. So yeah, I wouldn't agree with that.
What do you think, James?
Well, as I said before, I felt this season's felt fresh. It's not felt totally fresh as I'd like it to, and as I've said before, I think some of those things, it does fall back into similar practices. I think it still has to dare to tip its toe in doing something historical. I think it's got to avoid the going back every fourth episode and resolving meeting families, which I just don't think is needed. But I think it's doing it. I think that, as Gareth has said, this whole every episode being self-contained is a great move for this show. In a weird way, while we've come into an era where we're watching a lot of sort of serial narrative, which sort of has this sort of like Daredevil where we build up over a series and we watch an entire singular story, I think there is a bit of fatigue to that now. And I also think there's a question of where you watch it. And while Netflix is very great for sort of binge watching series, which are all constantly, where all the stories are interconnected, Doctor Who being on the BBC and perhaps having a different way of people watching stuff, singular episodes that they can miss, then go back and drop into and not feel that they're lost or that they're missing something greater, I think is probably quite a solid model for the show. I think it's been a lot of breaks this series. I think the writing's been largely fine. I think she does, as Gareth said earlier, I think to me she feels like a Peter Davison doctor, especially in the fact that she's lacks that there is a fallibility to her, a vulnerability to her. Like when she's tied up in this episode, you don't feel like you would with Matt Smith or Tennant or McCoy, that she could get out of those bonds. Okay, she gets out of the bonds underwater, to be fair, but that seemed to be the right time to do that. But there is a feeling that, you know, that she was under threat under the throughout the episode, which, again, I think is part of who she's going to be. But I think they've changed in the way, it feels like there's a change in the way they're writing her, and yet there probably isn't. It's just different writers.
Yeah.
But they seem to be getting away from her doing this sort of old-fashioned doctor, you know, don't cross me sort of moments. And her speeches seem to be a little more, I don't know, within her character.
You're right. Like, that's a really refreshing moment, that, yeah. Yeah.
More like Davison's sort of thing you'd imagine, again, that Davison's doctor would do, but you wouldn't imagine Tom Baker's doctor to do.
Yeah, that they came and went like a summer breeze. You know, that, I always think that that's Davison's era in a nutshell. It's her as well.
Yeah. And yeah. Especially, I knew, I thought it was good, you know, where Alan Cummings James she does this long pleading speech, which has a little effect on him, but it doesn't turn him. But that again feels very Davison as well.
Yeah.
That there's like slow chip away at people, but people aren't just bendable constructs. You can just make them do as you want.
And a sense you can't always win and you can't always change the situation, which is, you know, I mean, yeah, Davison has that. Davison loses as many as he wins, or the price for victory is sometimes very high. You're right to say there's elements of those early first Doctor, you know, like the Aztecs.
Yes.
He achieves absolutely nothing in that, really, other than getting them all out of there alive. You know, he knows that they can't change it. And even if they did change it, you know, the conquistadors will be there in a year and they'll all be dead. So,
well, yeah.
Maybe that's actually a story format which they seem to have avoided this new. Within the new show, stories where there isn't something to win, there is only simply to survive, which is obviously what the Aztecs and a lot of the early stories are. You're not there to defeat something so much as just get out. Marco Polo, again. I know these are historical ones, but there's no reason why you can't have these in alien surroundings. And one could argue Sleep No More is the nearest thing to that.
Yeah. I wonder if the format would allow you to do that now, though. That there has to be a sort of heroic payoff, that the Doctor has to be seen to effect change, and it's not just enough to get out alive, like Caves of Androzani, where really from 5 minutes in they're just trying to get out.
But this is the problem: if the show doesn't start looking at historicals or doesn't look at survival episodes, it's not really being the progressive, clever, groundbreaking show it thinks it is, if all the things it's doing are just things it's comfortably done in the past, and we can include regenerations and TARDISes and wacky dialogue and a smattering of diversity in the cast, a gender play in the main cast member. That's great as well. I'm not saying any of those things aren't good, but it should also be within what you're doing within the stories, and especially in this day and age where there is so much science fiction, there are so many anthologies and there's so many clever shows out there. You've got to use every tool at your disposal, and I just wonder whether there's some story formats it's just still scared of actually trying.
I think we'll see a change next year. I mean, I don't think any, I mean, he'll have done what, three of his 10 will have been historicals by the end of this, and that's a big chunk of his narrative. And I'll bet when the scores are in, assuming that the final episode isn't some great big huge return for the Daleks, then I'd imagine that one of those three historicals will end up being the most popular one of the year, and the others, if they're not top, will be in that top five. So I think your wish for a pure historical is probably going to be a lot closer as a result of this year.
Should also mention Heaven Sent as a survival episode as well.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, and
true.
A very popular one. So, yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I agree. I think that might be the way it goes. And as I said before, It's like when I was watching this, I was enjoying it and I was drawn in, not because of the potential or wondering what monster it would be or whether there was going to be a mud tentacle. The show doesn't need, because in the end, it's that old thing, isn't it? That most monsters in shows are just, you know, Nazis in fancy dress.
Mm.
Yeah, Daleks in a large way as the epitome. We don't need that to have the same sort of tensions, but sometimes it might just give the show a different feeling of character to play on that. And it doesn't mean these have to be educationally historical or attempt to be educational like some of the past have been. But I just think it would be interesting to try and do these sort of things where we're not just, because it's about defying expectations. And when you've been going for 55 years, you need to be trying to find ways to make sure that you yourselves are breaking formula. And this series is trying it. And the last series tried it as well. But you still feel there's a certain fear factor in both. Less so in this one than the last, but... Which is a shame, because the one thing I liked in the last, which they could have done in this show, this series, which should have helped in terms of what Christian was saying, would have been to have kept her based at the university. And if you'd had her based at the university, you could have had the third companion, Yaz, as a student, or even Ryan as a student, who could have popped in and out when you needed them. And you could have had them going around the universe or based at the university. We know that, you know, the sort of, you know, the after school special, the high school Buffy framework, even class to a degree, that sort of thing carries popularity. So you've got another level of different types of ventures you can play with.
But didn't we have one of Danny Pink's school kids travel with the Doctor for about 3 or 4 episodes, and we've all totally forgotten about that?
Well, we didn't forget about it. We sort of opened our heads.
Do you know what her name is? I can't remember what the character's name is.
The brain which that took. I know, but she was terrible.
Utterly unmemorable, really, you know, unfortunately.
But this is always the problem, isn't it? We've got to be careful that you can't vilify or create adoration over particular sort of role dynamics or role setups based on characters, because you could have three brilliant characters together, or you could have three terrible characters together. So the fact that having a situation where they'd be at university and they could have a semi-regular character who joins them, that semi-regular character could be an Adric, it could be a Mel, it could be a Turlo, it could be a Jamie. You can't. Do you know what I mean? It's down to how good they are at casting as much as it is about the position. But I just kind of feel that the university thing with the Doctor felt a little different. And just felt like it could give the show a little more openings in different ways, almost bring the unit and the escapism to space together into quite a nice hub, which wasn't just copying unit.
It's a good move, because obviously, you know, the military is a difficult thing to shoehorn into Doctor Who nowadays. Although, strangely enough, it should have been far more controversial in the early 70s when the British Army was, you know, I mean... You know, Bloody Sunday is right in the middle of the Pertwee era.
Yeah.
You know, and yet we're totally happy with the Doctor hanging out with the British Army. So maybe it takes a while for these things to sink in. But yeah, you're right. The university would have been a good unit substitute. But for whatever reason, they just becomes a place to park the TARDIS, and the Doctor has a study and a TARDIS. Oh, and a spare Doctor in Nardole.
Yeah. Well, I think that was while I thought Nardole was obviously a little too comical at times. I think it was nice to have that. It functioned that way, didn't it? It brought in a third. I would still like to have two regular companions, and then you have an optional third.
Captain
works
Jack Model. Yeah.
Because I think the problem with the Doctor, because we all have such diverse tastes, finding us to have a character, a Doctor, and a companion that we all love is very difficult. To a Doctor, companion, and a companion, there's an extra chance of finding someone you quite like in that dynamic, which I think is why sometimes it's one of the reasons it works. I found the Doctor and Amy quite irritating, but the Doctor, Amy, and Rory I found far more bearable. So Amy, Rory, and River, like, oh.
Yeah, Amy and Rory, not so keen. In fact, most of the Moff era companions don't do anything for me, actually, now I think back, apart from maybe Nardole, who I quite like, and Bill was pretty good. So, but that was right at the end. Actually, we've got my favourite trio of companions, which is Dr. Leela and K-9.
Yeah.
That's the closest I think you get to the Kirk, Spock, Bones sort of three elements of the personality all in one place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pure logic, pure instinct, and a little bit of both.
Well, that seems like an apt place to leave discussion of Doctor Who with a quick crazy of Star Trek. I'm going to...
We do seem to have gas-bagged on for a bit, sorry.
I'm going to challenge you both with a rating for this episode. I'm going to give it 7, I think, thanks to Alan Cummings. Without him, I would probably be giving it, hitting a 5 at it. 7 out of 10 for me. Gareth?
9.
9.
I know I've got old Bruno Tonioli on this. He's a 9. it's a 9, yeah. Without Cummings, it's a 6.
Okay. James?
I think I'll go with a 7 as well.
Whoa!
I liked it, but the last 5-10 minutes was just so absurd and messy. It just fell apart for me. This is
the closest we've agreed all season, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Absolutely.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay, well, listener, let us know what you thought. And obviously there's a Facebook which you can add to, or you can let us know in response to this podcast. Very nice to have Gareth with us again.
Always a treat.
Always a treat and a pleasure.
Do we need to mark last episodes?
Last week's
episode. Oh, go on. We might as well, for completeness. Yes.
Last week was Kablam, wasn't it? Kablam, yeah. I enjoyed that. I'd probably give it 7.5, I think.
Well, we can't have halves. That's cheating.
Yes, we can. It's been established in a prior episode.
75, then, if you need to take the decimal out.
Yes.
Yes. What about you, John?
It's a hard one, that. I think there wasn't much to it, but it was a deliciously trad slice of Who, and I did enjoy it. So I would say, enjoyment-wise, but I wouldn't watch it again, so I'm waffling. So, yeah, it's a 7.
Okay. And James?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It did feel a little like, as I said before, like something I could have seen many, many times before in Doctor Who, but it did that very, very well. So from, I guess, I feel forced to give it I don't want to give it a 7.5 because that would be like 2 in a row. I'll go for an 8. I did think it was pretty good.
Okay. Okay, maybe we'll get around to totting these up. Maybe we won't. Who knows? It's just for fun.
So what do we think's coming in the finale then? Because there doesn't seem to be much info on. Next week looks like a great, creepy Swedish shed thing.
Yes, it's the Scandinoir episode, isn't it?
That looks fun. But we don't know anything about the finale, which makes me think that the Daleks must be coming back.
Well, a lot of people have suggested that. I mean, one of the best things about the series, I think, have been the fact that we don't know what's coming and that no old villains have been used. And I think if you are going to go down that route of using Daleks, then you've got to do something very, very different with them. And I'm not convinced that Chibnall is the person to instigate that.
Why is that?
I just don't find anything that he's done to be... So far, you know, be,
in terms of the actual... Let's flip that on its head. The person who's done consistently the most different things with the Daleks is Stephen Moffat. And I don't think any of his Dalek stories have worked. So something a little bit more traddy may not be a bad thing for the Daleks.
Maybe.
It's always been like, you know, birthday party of the Daleks or, you know... Scarborough Day Out with the Daleks, or, you know, Existential Crisis of the Daleks.
How about Cummings with the Daleks?
Ooh.
I would say Pine of the Ways. Pine of the Ways and that thing, Bad Wolf. Stolen Earth, that thing. And Day of the Daleks, Death of the Daleks.
They're quite trad Dalek stories, though, really.
They're not, though, are they? They're traditional sort of comic strip Dalek stories. They're not really traditional Doctor Who on TV Dalek stories, I don't feel. You know, there was never a budget to steal Earth, was there? No, to actually steal Earth. A budget to attempt to steal Earth.
Well, that's true.
Yes, yes. or to actually steal her. So I think they put the Daleks in a good light, and obviously the end, the very end there of the story.
It had a global feel to it, and they did something interesting with Davros.
I agree with you, the Moffat era Dalek stories. I think that they're an absolute waste of time. The Asylum of the Daleks with a bloody Dalek Parliament, and
Everything's just an attempt to do something slightly crackers with the Daleks, and that's fine. But if you're only ever doing crackers things with the Daleks, it becomes just a slightly crackers mess.
The most crackers thing to do with the Daleks would be to actually do something traditional and actually have them.
Oh yeah.
You could almost replicate the Dead Planet without the Thal's involvement for 45 minutes, because you've only got 45 minutes, and have these three characters introduced and have to survive a city of the Daleks and get back to the TARDIS. And that in itself would be something very different.
But there are
I think you're probably in the right area, but just forget about the Daleks and worry about the Thals.
Yeah. I remember having a great chat with a writer who pitched me a wonderful idea, who said, you know, we've never really addressed why the Thals are actually still around for much of the time when the Daleks can conquer anything and yet they're still there on Skaro. And he said, well, how about if they just keep this sort of little captive population of Thals who survived must be the ultimate, you know, warriors to survived in the nestling in the armpit of the Daleks, and actually they go in there to fight them as a thing of honor. That sounded fun. I remember Ben Aronovich had pitched his next Dalek story would have been where the Doctor arrives in a city that's under assault, and it's a last party of Daleks that are being exterminated by something even more ruthless, and the Doctor has to save the Daleks. That's fun. They're more interesting, and actually I'm going to say that I loved seeing the Mavellans a couple of years ago in a cameo, but I loved seeing the Mavellans. I'd like to, there are more interesting things to do, and there are more trad things to do, so I think Chibnall is absolutely the person to do something a little bit more meat and potatoes but dramatically satisfying with the Daleks. Let's see.
Okay. Well, we will see. We'll see in a couple of weeks. And
if they're coming back.
If they're coming back. And can we perhaps get you back in time for that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I tend to... Now there's not much telly to watch on a Monday morning because The Walking Dead's finished this week. I'll be glad to join you on a Monday. No problem.
Excellent. And we hope you join us as well, dear listener. Until next time, it's goodbye from myself, from James McLean, and from Gareth Cavana.
This is a Beyond Casterbrews podcast. Available on iTunes, Audioboom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrews.com.